Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 436th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta.
And Mike, go ahead.
No, you say what you need to say.
Oh, no, I was going to...
You're chomping at the bit.
I am, and I know you were going to introduce the person who's going to be helping us out with this question, but I thought I'd tease the audience with the question first. Are you okay with that?
I'm captivated.
Yeah, me too, because I don't even know what it is, but well, let's go from there. So what we're going to be talking about is a type of question that comes up all the time, where we hear an old drug or a drug that's been around for a long time is associated with something. There's a study that comes out and says it's associated with cancer or heart disease or anything to do with that. And so just recently there was a report suggesting that hydrochlorothiazide is associated with some sort of skin cancers. And it got a fair amount of press. And so we looked into the answer to it. And when I say we, I don't mean me, but our guest who's with us today.
So I'm going to introduce Sam, who some of you who've listened to the podcast before know, but Sam, can you introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, my name is Samantha Moe, and I'm a clinical pharmacist in my previous life, but now I work for the College of Family Physicians of Canada, helping to develop education for family doctors. And I worked on this tools for practice with Dr. Tina Koronik and as well as Dr. Braden O'Neill, asking the question of, does hydrochlorothiazide increase the risk of squamous cell carcinoma of the skin?
And James, you're right. This is going to be, first of all, thanks for joining us, Sam, because we need your help on this. And this is going to be one of those questions where it's going to be addressed by observational information. And so we're going to need to apply, and there should be a drum roll, insert that later. We're going to need to apply the rules of causation here, James.
I love those rules.
I know you're a man who doesn't normally like the rules, but these rules you do.
I'm okay with it. Yeah, and we'll work. Now we'll talk about the specific question and then generalities around how we deal with sort of observational data.
Yeah, and one of the things at the outset we should clarify is, as James indicated, these things exist. There's associations with everything. So shark attacks and ice cream is associated. Yeah. All sorts of things like that. That doesn't mean they're causing each other. And when you have a drug that's been around a long time and is used heavily, you can research if it's connected to anything,
yeah,
whether it's connected to dental cavities, hair loss, aggressive behavior, motor vehicle crashes, you name it. So,
and I was going to say, when you have thousands of investigators or researchers out there looking, you do find things sometimes. And that's why it's going to be, I think, really useful for Sam to help us go through what was found and how to put it into context.
Mm-hmm. All right, Sam. That is an excellent lead-in for us. Now dazzle us with your knowledge.
So James is right. There was an alert put out by Health Canada about a year ago now, saying that they found the best available evidence indicates that hydrochlorothiazide may be associated with an increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancer. So we went back and pulled out all the data to see what it actually said. So the first thing we found was a systematic review. It was published in 2019, and they found 9 observational studies, so 2 cohort studies and 7 case control studies of over 395,000 patients. And they wanted to see what that association was between thiazide diuretics and the risk of skin cancer. So they looked at squamous cell carcinoma, they looked at basal cell carcinoma, and as well malignant melanoma. But we'll just focus on squamous cell carcinoma for today. And what they found was that there was an association of squamous cell carcinoma with thiazide diuretics, and it was associated with an odds ratio of about 2. So these guys then went on to do a subgroup analysis just to pull out hydrochlorothiazide and combinations of drug that included hydrochlorothiazide just to see what that risk was. And again, it showed an odds ratio of 2.
And maybe, we could help the audience and explain like what an odds ratio of 2 would mean, like contextually.
Right. And so an odds ratio, so we have complained in the past, not me because I'm very easygoing, but James has.
And the odds that Mike will be rude to me on a podcast is like 100%, even though that's not what odds are.
Even though that's not what odds are. Odds are used when events are rare. They're particularly useful there, and they're particularly useful in observational studies like case control studies and, to an extent, cohort studies. That's where they really have a great home, and it's for rare events. So the use of odds ratios here is quite appropriate because we've complained about their use in common events like the cold or that kind of thing in randomized controlled trials. But here, this is quite appropriate. And generally, when events are rare, an odds ratio of 2 means that it's doubling the chance of something happen. So if your chance of having skin cancer is 0.5% per year, it would go up to 1%.
No, exactly. Perfect.
Is that okay, James?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay.
So then when they went to look on further to patients who had been on hydrochlorothiazide for a longer period of time, so at least 4.5 years or 4 to 5 years, they found that this was also associated with a higher risk of squamous cell carcinoma, an odds ratio of 3. So they're showing an association with longer term use as well. We can talk a little bit about the limitations of this particular systematic review. A lot of unmeasured confounders were in this were not reported, so there's not a lot of patient data around things like how much sun exposure a patient got, or what their family history was of having skin cancer, or what their skin color was even. So there's a lot of potential confounders here. This data is also subject to recall and detection bias, and they did a lot of comparisons. So there's certainly there's some considerable limitations around this data.
And those are, Sam, I'm sure you'd agree that those are the typical limitations that we're going to see with any type of data that looks for this sort of association.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so this is that these are important limitations, but they're almost hand in hand with every case control type study. Mm-hmm. The concerns are a little less with cohort, but it doesn't mean this data is completely invalid. And you can see that Sam and her team were trying to give us some of the hints about the rules of causation. So she showed the data was consistent looking at it in different ways. She showed that the duration of use actually made it worse and those kind of things. So they're starting already to kind of show us that the rules of causation might indicate that something is real here.
Right.
So the next thing we looked at was a large and one of the largest case control studies that we came across, and it wasn't included in the systematic review we just talked about. It was published in 2018. And they really wanted to see if there was a dose response with hydrochlorothiazide causing squamous cell carcinoma. So when they looked at a cumulative dose of hydrochlorothiazide of greater than 50,000 milligrams, which would be, let's say, 25 milligrams a day over 6 years, the odds ratio associated with that cumulative dose was 4. And then when they looked at patients who had a cumulative dose of over 200,000 milligrams, so approximately 20 years of use, let's say, that odds ratio was 7.4. So these authors concluded that, and they did a bunch of cumulative doses in between those two extremes, and increasingly the odds ratio continued to go up. So they concluded that there was a dose-response relationship here with hydrochlorothiazide and this risk.
And again, one of the causation attributes that we look for is this sort of a dose response relationship, because it would make sense that higher doses should increase, if it's a real risk, should increase it.
Yeah, and the longer you go and
the longer
all
duration,
of those.
Yeah.
And then what you're also looking for is consistency in results. So if you harken back to probably one of the best uses of observational data was the verifying that smoking causes cancer, you could see that in every study that looked at it. Mm-hmm. So now the odds ratio, I'm not trying to compare these because the odds ratios there are 16. There's 16 times.
For smoking.
Yeah, for smoking and lung cancer. Mm-hmm. So I'm not trying to apply the risk of taking hydrochlorothiazide and causing squamous cell cancer is the same as smoking and lung cancer by any stretch. I'm just talking about it is the best example of applying the rules of causation that we have.
Mm-hmm. And while we're on the topic of rules of causation, like we talk about whether there's plausible mechanism behind whether hydrochlorothiazide could pharmacologically be associated with. And so hydrochlorothiazide is a photosensitizing agent. And so arguably there is a pharmacological kind of biological plausibility for it to be occurring.
And for someone who's sickly pale most of their life, mm-hmm. I can tell you that photosensitizing someone like me only would make things a lot worse. So what we're missing here, as you said, is different skin tones and susceptibilities and sun exposure and all sorts of things like that. But as you said, this is verification that there is some kind of biologic plausibility behind this potential risk.
Next, we found this case control study that looked specifically at the risk of squamous cell carcinoma of the lip. And so they, too, also observed a dose-response effect with a cumulative dose of over 100,000 milligrams of hydrochlorothiazide. Their odds ratio was 7.7, and this is kind of the highest cumulative dose that they explored. And then we saw, again, a dose-response curve leading up to that as well. There is another systematic review out there, and it actually showed no effect of thiazides as a class on squamous cell carcinoma. However, they didn't include all the hydrochlorothiazide studies that were included in that original systematic review I talked about. So because hydrochlorothiazide seems to be driving this risk of squamous cell carcinoma, it makes sense that this systematic review that didn't include hydrochlorothiazide didn't show any effect. So that's also for consideration. Finally, we didn't really concentrate too much on basal cell carcinoma, but if that risk does exist, the risk is thought to be quite small, and what we found was an odds ratio of 1.2 or 1.3 if it's really real. So what we're really focusing on for now is the squamous cell carcinoma.
Yeah, and there's lots of talk that a ratio of 1.2 or 1.3 is, mm-hmm. is, even if real, is likely irrelevant. For most things,
So basically, Mike, you've just trashed all nutritional research.
I know. I have, James, and thank you for bringing that up because I wanted that and I wanted to do it subtly, like a brick.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't mean all nutritional research, but a lot of it finds these relatively small associations, and it is exceedingly confusing to sort of make heads or tails out of it. But when we're talking about with these things, with odds ratios of, you know, the 7 or 8s or 4 or 5s, I mean, it's something that you need to start to think a little bit about. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Okay, cool.
And so, Sam, how do we put some of this in context? Because one of the problems is when we apply an odds ratio, if we don't know what the baseline risk is, mm-hmm. it's really not that helpful. So
yeah, so Tina did a lot of work trying to dig up what that baseline risk of a squamous cell carcinoma really is. And after a lot of digging, the report that we thought would be most appropriate was one that came out of the UK. And before I tell you what the number is, just to recognize that baseline risk of squamous cell carcinoma it varies with age, with sex, with geographical location, with patient ethnicity. So there's a lot of factors that go into considering this baseline risk. But in the UK cohort that they studied, the incidence was 77 cases per 100,000 people. And so just to put that in percentage, that risk, that baseline risk of developing squamous cell carcinoma is less than 0.1% per year. And then to put that further into context, the risk of developing metastatic squamous cell carcinoma is about 1.1 to, let's say, 2.5% of patients who had originally developed the cancer. So the risk is low, mm-hmm. And the risk of developing metastatic cancer is also.
Is another subset of that, even a lower subset of that. Yeah, yeah.
But I guess it all hinges on the fact that 0.1% is like obviously an older person of very light skin living in an area of high sun exposure. Like there are a lot of people out there who love to get a lot of sun and they're obviously high risk. So it would change with them and that would be higher. And I don't know how that would impact the metastatic risk, if it would at all, but it does certainly impact your risk of developing it. Mm-hmm. So 0.1 is, I mean, with a 2-odds ratio, it doesn't seem very dramatic. But it is still like the rules of causation were well applied and wasn't entirely consistent, but quite consistent. James, you were going
to
say something?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say when you apply the odds ratios to the 0.1, I mean, any increased risk has to be put into the equation of other benefits and so on. But yeah, I mean, it's really important to realize that every time you see an odds ratio or a relative risk number, you need to ask what was the problem or the baseline in the first place. And, you know, it's sometimes very difficult to find that. And I think, you know, 0.1% is probably a pretty good, you know, number to use, but it's really hard to be really confident on it. But I think you can go, if it is real, instead of 0.1% per year, it goes up to 0.4 or point, you know, whatever your multiplier is. And again, with a huge sort of confidence interval around all of this stuff, but it's the best ballpark you can make. And it helps you put it into context when you're trying to make a decision on an individual patient, because it's always a balance of benefits and harms.
It's interesting, Sam, you said that Tina was the one that found all this, and it doesn't surprise me. She can be tenacious when she has a piece of information that's important to the story, that she will chase that down. But, but you know, if you take that 0.1% per year and make it 10 years, you might say it might be 1%, and then it might be 4% if as James suggested, if you kind of look at it over a longer time frame and so on. And then you can start to think, well, there is maybe some risk there. So what are some of the other, if all that was real, which we're not suggesting we know that for sure, but it is a concern. So what are the other pieces we have to balance? Like with these drugs, hydrochlorothiazide, maybe not so much, but the thiazide-like diuretics are pretty helpful in reducing the adverse events associated with hypertension.
Yeah, so in terms of like the thiazide-like agents such as chlorthalidone or indapamide, we haven't seen from the data that those particular thiazide-like agents increase the risk of squamous cell carcinoma. So you could consider using those, and I don't think we've seen that it's been associated with a risk, and we know that they're associated with morbidity and mortality benefits in randomized trials. And when we're talking about these observational studies that we've just talked about, like these non-randomized trials can overestimate some of the harmful effects and maybe some of the beneficial effects. So it's hard to prove anything really.
Right.
And if you were just to look at the evidence around what thiazide or thiazide-like agent to use, you would definitely be leaning in favor of chlorthalidone anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Position.
Yeah. Even though hydrochlorothiazide was far, far and away, at least in North America, the main thiazide that was used for years and years, not just on its own, but in combination products like diazide and all that.
And I think we looked at this years ago, James, and it had to do with when they were first coming to the market, who had a better marketing scheme and was giving better prices to groups like Veterans Affairs. And that's what we had heard, I think, in a conversation years ago when we were together down in the States doing some talks.
Yeah, but that's just because you're cynical.
Yeah. But so why did hydrochlorothiazide versus chlorothalidone? We know that chlorothalidone is more likely to cause electrolyte disturbances and things like that. So that's a bit of a pain. It means we just have to watch for that a little bit more. But it does definitely have a better blood pressure effect. And as James said, if you're looking at outcomes data, it definitely has... Hydrochlorothiazide struggles a bit to find data that strongly supports it for reducing cardiovascular events like we've seen with chlorothalidone. Yeah.
And I know you've been waiting for it, Mike, but the way to reduce the risk of any sort of the potassiums and the sodium problems is use a low dose.
Bing!
Exactly.
You knew. Please check the time of this podcast to see whether you won.
Yeah. But we've been talking about dose responses in the past. It's an important dose response. If you at least when I started practice, it wouldn't be unusual to see doses of hydrochlorothiazide of 50 or 100 milligrams a day. And in that circumstance, and this is sort of dredging my mind for the data that we looked at way back when. If you use those sorts of doses, you would see patients, probably 10% of them would develop hypokalemia. That's almost an unacceptable level. Whereas if you start with, a quarter of that or an eighth of that, we're talking maybe 1 or 2%, if I remember the data correctly. And so it's still something you need to be aware of, but it is very much a dose response.
Yeah, chlorothalidone has around a 4% risk of electrolyte disturbance. And there's old tools for practice the listeners can check out on that kind of information. But you're right. And dose response, and here I am feeding into your disorder. But you're totally right. With hypertension, you get the biggest bang for your buck with that low dose. So 12.5 of chlorothalidone will get you almost all the way as 25 milligrams of chlorothalidone.
And even less than that, if there's some data on that. Yeah. So this came out about a year ago. So what would you guys do? So you've got a patient who, let's say they've been on hydrochlorothiazide for forever.
And they're doing well. They're not at risk for this. I think the general consensus is there's not enough there for us to start changing people willy-nilly. But I think that if I have a patient coming in who's at risk, or this is a good time. I also push this when people aren't quite at target with hydrochlorothiazide. I suggest, rather than adding agents, to switch them to chlorothalidone. That saves being on a second pill, and that kind of. So I think switching when it's appropriate and likely needed. If I had a patient with a history of squamous cell cancer on thiazides, I would likely, if I could draw that connection during the brief part of the visit that was involving blood pressure, I would try and remember to make that switch or talk to them about that switch.
Yeah. And if for no other reason is that they might read about this.
Yeah. If it was someone who's not really at risk, relatively young, no other things, and their blood pressure's being really well controlled with hydrochlorothiazide, I don't think I'd make a change.
Yeah. What you might do is just mention it.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, sorry, Sam, go ahead.
I was going to say counseling about surveillance for new or changing moles and counseling about sun exposure safety, if they're going to continue on hydrochlorothiazide, would be reasonable.
Yeah. And you should be doing that regardless of what medications they're on.
Yeah, and this is more, people might call them moles or whatever, but they're more classic sun damaged skin. And so it's red, kind of crusty spots that look angry and those kind of things. Those are the appearance of that, early actinic keratoses, watching for them to transition to squamous and all that. And if you're wondering about what's the best treatment for actinic keratoses and preventing, making them go away so they don't transition to squamous cell, there's also a tools for practice on that.
Yeah. So we'll put links to all of the stuff that we've talked about in the podcast. So Sam, that was great. A really useful overview of this, because it's a question that people would now have because of the reports. And so it's hopefully what we're trying to do with these podcasts is give you specific information, but help people think through what do you do when you see this type of information. And you guys did a great job of that.
Yeah, they did an amazing job. Okay,
cool. So I don't think there's much else we need to say, Mike. I think our course is coming up April 24th, 25th. We've got all the speakers lined up. We're just about to post the schedule or the agenda for the program. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. There'll be a lot of useful pieces of information that you guys, if you want to come to Vancouver and hang out with us for a couple of days, that would be brilliant. And anything else, Mike?
No, I think that's it, James.
Okay, so I think... that would be nice if I could say it properly. I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thanks.